I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate. The United States is undergoing a massive energy transformation. Hydraulic fracturing, which has allowed energy companies to access huge reserves of natural gas and oil, is altering communities, the economy, our foreign policy, and even the future health of the planet. In The Boom, Wall Street Journal energy reporter Russell Gold takes a look at the history of fracking and how the technology has changed the world. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm pleased to welcome Russell to our program today. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So how long have you been on the fracking beat? It's been 10 years?
A little more than 10 years, yeah. I started covering energy for the Journal back in 2002, and it was in July of 2003 that an Oklahoma City company said, well, why don't you come over and take a look at what we're doing outside of Fort Worth? And nobody had any idea what this fracking was at that point.
Right. And this book is... It's interesting because there are a lot of people who are either fracking advocates or anti-fracking polemicists.
Fractivists,
yes. But your book is basically it's a great piece of reporting, and you're saying that fracking is here to stay. It's become a huge part of the world economy. So we're sort of living in dreamland if we're thinking that it's going to go away anytime soon.
Well, yeah, no, that's absolutely true. I mean, we are fracking 100 wells a day in the United States. Canada is very active, too. Mexico really wants to get into it, as does Russia. You know, it is spreading. So we certainly can have the discussion, should we or shouldn't we be fracking? But I think it's a more reasonable discussion to have since we are fracking. What steps can we do to try to protect communities, protect the environment while still getting some of the benefits from it?
Now, early in the book, you write about how your parents were offered $400,000 plus royalties for the rights to drill for natural gas on their property in rural Pennsylvania. What town did you live in?
I grew up in Philadelphia. This was land that my parents owned with some of their friends, so it wasn't all for them. North of Eaglesmere, Pennsylvania, north central Pennsylvania, in Sullivan County.
And how did you feel about the offer at the time?
Well, it really...
It's a lot of money.
Yeah, no, it is a lot of money. I mean, even split amongst a number of people. You know, I was really... It tore me out of being a journalist because I had been covering this for several years at that point. I had just gotten back from Pittsburgh where I was covering the growth of this Marcellus Shale, which no one had heard of. And, you know, I had covered it as a business reporter. What were the companies doing? What were the effects? And all of a sudden, I was being asked this very, you know, deep question. Should we allow a company to come drill on our land? And, you know, if so, how should we do it? I mean, is this the right thing to do? And it really forced me to think a lot about that bigger question, because that's in the United States is having, you know, is facing the same question that my parents did, which is, should we be embracing fracking and natural gas and some of the energy that comes with it, or should we push it away?
Now, in the book, you refer to hydraulic fracking as revolutionary. What in your mind makes it revolutionary?
Well, we have been drilling for oil and gas for 150 years in the United States, and we were essentially running out of what we thought was here. You know, oil production had been declining since the 70s. We were about to start importing lots of natural gas. We already import enormous amounts of oil. We were played out. The United States was just tapped out. And suddenly, the engineers figured out that you could go into this new form of rock. And this is the source rock. This is where oil and gas comes from. And use it to get and crack it open, fracture it to get the oil and gas out. Previously, if you were an engineer and you drilled into that rock, you would probably get fired. You weren't supposed to go to that rock. You were supposed to stay away from it. And so it was all of a sudden we went from being energy paupers to having an abundance of energy under our feet. It was a 180-degree change.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us a brief primer on how this works?
Yeah, sure.
How does one frack?
Okay. Well, first you drill a well, goes down vertically, usually a couple miles, and then you turn the well so it runs horizontal, parallel to the surface, and usually go out a mile or two. And essentially, what you're doing is you're taking frack fluid, which is 99% water, and then chemicals. Along mixed in with sand and usually a lot of guar, which is a bean paste that you find in McDonald's milkshakes. And you inject it, you sort of carve out about 100 to 200 foot section of the rock, and you pump the water in under incredible pressure.
What kind of pressure are you talking about?
Oh, it's hundreds of times what you'd find in a in your car tire.
Okay.
One of the analogies I use is that if you were to sit, you know, if you sort of think about swimming down to the bottom of a swimming pool, you know, you feel the pressure in your eardrums at 8 feet. Well, imagine sitting at 12,000 feet, the deepest point in the Gulf of Mexico. The pressure of the water above you is still not equal to the pressure that they're pumping the water in. It's just extraordinary. And water doesn't really compress. So when you pump water against even super dense rock, eventually the rock will fracture and crack. And one of the interesting statistics that I encountered is that the calculation of how much an average frack will expose, how long the fingers, the fracturing fingers are, is that it's equal to about 35, the floor space of 35 giant malls. It's just an absolutely enormous amount of fracturing that happens when it begins.
And these wells are drilled very close to each other, right?
Oh, sure, absolutely.
And why is that?
Because the cracks don't go very far. Mm-hmm. So if you want to get all of the oil and gas out of the rock, then you need to drill wells close to each other because, you know, essentially you want the fingers to get the maximum exposure to the rock. You can't, there's not a big drainage area. If you sort of think about older wells, you'd be able to drain from a large area. This is a much smaller area because it's so hard to crack the rock. It's not like those cracks are traveling a mile. They're traveling a couple hundred feet.
So this whole issue of fracking and the whole process has entered the public consciousness fairly recently. But you actually walk us through kind of a history of fracking. This goes back to the 19th century, right?
Well, yeah, it's interesting you should say that because even the history of fracking is controversial. Nothing about this is not controversial. You know, the people who are opposed to fracking will say, well, we've only been doing this 10 years. It's a brand new technology. It's untested. The industry celebrates how old it is. In fact, I got an email, 65th birthday card from someone in the industry of sort of happy 65th anniversary of fracking. I actually think it goes all the way even further back than that. And if you go back to the first couple of years after the first oil wells were drilled in western Pennsylvania, there was this guy who actually lived here in New York City, was a lieutenant colonel in the Union Army, and devised while leading his troops in battle in the Battle of Fredericksburg, noticed how shells that landed around him exploded in one way, but shells that landed under in this ditch covered with water exploded a different way. And he thought, well, I could use that to try to blow up the bottom of the wells that they're drilling out in western Pennsylvania. So he goes out there in the 1860s and starts putting basically large dynamite charges down at the bottom of wells, covering them up with water and setting them off. And, you know, he's so successful that Colonel Drake, who's remembered as the father of petroleum, he drilled the first well, he dies penniless. I mean, he can't make a go of it like many wildcatters. This guy, Colonel Roberts, dies one of the wealthiest men in the United States because everyone loved this invention because it made oil wells better, made them more productive.
I'm Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate, and I am talking about the history and the present and the future of fracking with Wall Street Journal energy reporter Russell Gold, who has a new book on the subject called The Boom. Now, most of the industry, fracking industry that we read about or hear about, is concentrated in North Dakota, the Bakken Shale, mm-hmm. and we hear about the Marcellus Shale in Pennsylvania. But where else is this going on in the United States?
Well, all throughout Texas. South Texas has a giant Eagle Ford Shale. The Permian Basin, this famous old oil field, has been completely rejuvenated by fracking. They're going back into old wells. Ohio, Oklahoma, and then there's some very serious attempts to frack the Monterey Shale in California. Unsuccessful so far. They can frack it, they just can't quite figure out how to make it work. So in the United States, that's where it is. And then the Eagle Ford Shale, which I talk about in South Texas, goes right under the border. Northern Mexico is full of it, and Mexico is starting to look at it. And then up in British Columbia and Alberta and Western Canada, there's a huge amount of activity going on right now. And then once you start talking internationally, Argentina, South Africa, China, Russia. The United States is the envy of the world right now for its low cost of energy, and a number of other countries would love to follow suit and try to get the fracking industry to take off where they are.
And are we on track to be the world's largest energy supplier? That is bizarre.
It's unbelievable to think
and
of.
And so sudden. It's been a very rapid development.
Well, I mean, you talk about the Bakken in North Dakota. A couple of years ago, this was an inconsequential oil field, and now it's just knocking on 1 million barrels a day. And to put that in perspective so you understand it, that's larger than two members of OPEC. It's larger. So, you know, North Dakota could go apply for membership in OPEC, I suppose, if they wanted to. You know, I sometimes have these visions of Governor Dalrymple from North Dakota going to Vienna to meet with the other OPEC leaders. I don't think that's going to happen, but that's how big that one oil field is. And the Eagle Ford has grown just as much, and people talk about the Utica in eastern Ohio potentially. So it's remarkable how quickly it's grown.
How it's such a rapid development, how insane has that been culturally in North Dakota? I mean, it must just be turning the place into a different planet.
Yeah, it's a good way of putting it. I mean, you know, there are cities in North Dakota where one out of every four people moved there in the last year or two. Traffic is unbelievable. I was up in North Dakota and I drove through this tiny little town called Watford City. Just a couple thousand people in one of those one light towns. And people warned me about the traffic. And lo and behold, when you get there, you're stuck, you know, in a mile long series of trucks. And you can't underestimate when you're in the middle of a frac field how many trucks there are. Pickup trucks, tractor trailers, water hauling trucks, sand hauling trucks. There are trucks everywhere.
Has this brought along all the attendant problems of crime and prostitution, drugs, all that stuff?
Meth uses up in a lot of places. Yeah, no, absolutely. It's you're talking about a lot of young men usually who are making very good livings and you know, six-figure salaries sometimes working in the field. This is hard work and they don't have anything to do. So yes, we do see all of that. And if you're lucky enough to run a bar in South Texas or Western North Dakota, you're going to do quite well for yourself. If you have good bouncers, I suppose.
Now, you visited a well in North Dakota just as it was being fracked. What was that experience like?
Well, it was really interesting because fracking, you know, as we've been talking about, has really provided this huge boost to the economy. It's changing our politics. It's you know, we're having these big discussions about, is it helping or hurting the economy, the environment. But almost nobody, no journalists have gone to write about the experience of being there. And what's fascinating about it is just how scripted everything is. And we're talking about dozens of workers that they're literally building a factory in the middle of the prairie, and they're assembling it in 2 weeks. They're going to do their thing, then they disassemble it and move a couple miles down the road to do it again. And so you get there, and you know, you can't even walk over this 2-acre pad because there's so many pipes underneath your foot. I mean, you could trip if you're not looking carefully. And then you go into the data van, which is where everything's run from. And you know, the best way to imagine it, you know, so there's all these guys sitting in front of computers, these big windows where they're looking out and ordering people around. But if you think about those pictures of like a NASA control center when they're doing a moon launch or launching a satellite, except instead of kind of crew cuts and starched shirts, it's guys in gimme caps and overalls and just, you know, large facial hair and flowing hair, because there are actually not enough people to cut hair up in North Dakota. So that's a problem. You know, it's sort of NASA meets NASCAR.
So what does it sound like? What does it feel like when that's being done?
When the frack actually happens, mm-hmm. it's so far underfoot. That you don't hear anything.
Nothing.
In fact, I had to sit there. I had to have someone show me where on the monitor it was going to show you when the frack actually took place. But when you get outside, you know, there's fine sand dust in the air. When you go into the chemical vans, there's this sickly sweet smell. It is loud. I mean, you have to imagine just machine after machine after machine just sitting there working their hardest to pump water down to crack this rock. So it's when you're outside the data van, everyone wants to work inside the data van. Because you work outside the data van, you're talking about 8 hours, 12 hours just standing in the freezing cold. Inside the data van, you know, you strip down to your T-shirt. They've got Pink Floyd playing. You know, it's a much nicer
environment. You said they have Dark Side of the Moon was accompanying a frack.
You know, it was one day it was Dark Side of the Moon. The next day it was Cat Scratch Fever.
Oh, okay.
I guess it depends on what their mood
is. That's a bad night to be there on the night that Cat Scratch Fever is playing. Once the well is drilled, how long is the shale in that well productive for?
Well, the wells themselves, they're sort of overachievers. They will do very well in the first year and then dribble off. You know, you can lose 60% of production the first year and then another 60% the second year. But to answer your question, we don't really know.
Mm-hmm.
The world's first modern shale well was drilled in 1998. And when I say modern, using all this horsepower and all this water instead of some of the older wells that they had done. So that gives us 16 years. So it's sort of interesting when I hear the industry talk about the 20 and 30 year life of these wells, you think to myself, well, how do you really know? Because we have exactly one data point that's lasted 16 years. And it really wasn't until 2002 or 2003 that we started drilling a lot of these. So there's certainly some questions remaining about how productive they are. I personally think that given the history of the oil industry, these guys are really good at extracting as much as they can from the wells. They will find technology to keep nursing these wells to get more oil and gas out of them.
Now, you talked about the fluid that's used, the fracking fluid, and it's mainly water.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are these chemicals, like the kind of chemicals that are used in McDonald's shakes. That's
That's not a chemical. That's just a
bean.
Well,
that's a bean product.
But there are lots of – they're biocides.
Mm-hmm.
Friction reducer is a big one. You want to sort of soapy – make the water kind of soapy and slick because there's so much friction in pumping the water down. So, yeah, there are a lot of chemicals, and it's a serious industrial process. There's no question about it.
Mm-hmm. Now – what do we know about the effects of putting these chemicals into the ground? Is this something that sort of – are we kind of drilling first and asking questions later? Are we not really thinking this through? Like
That's the American way, isn't it?
It is, very much so.
You know, and it's interesting you should say that because a lot of countries in Europe want proof that this is safe before they'll allow it. You know, sort of ask questions, and then
that's why we're number one in fracking, my friend.
Well, you know, you're absolutely right. I mean, that's why we have so much energy because we do drill first,
right,
and ask questions later. I personally, you know, I think it's a real shame that 10 years after we really began this massive amount of drilling, we're just now getting around to asking these critically important questions: how much methane, how much natural gas is leaking out of these wells, and what's the impact on the climate? How can we be sure we're building wells that will hold up for 30, 40, 50 years in the ground and not leak methane or chemicals into the aquifer? These are all really important questions. They are being asked right now, and some fixes are emerging. Would have been nice to maybe have started this 7 or 8 years ago when this was just in its infancy.
I want to talk about those fixes in a moment. I'm speaking with Wall Street Journal investigative reporter Russell Gold about his reporting on fracking over the last decade and how our quest for domestic energy has changed the national economy, our environment, and the world. His book, The Boom, How Fracking Ignited the American Energy Revolution and Changed the World, is published by Simon & Schuster. And we'll be back with more after a break. I'm Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate. Today we've had Kristen Wiig, Rob Lowe, and now we're ending on a high note, fracking. I'm here with Russell Gold. He's an energy reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and he's written a new book called The Boom, and it's all about the revolution in fracking in the United States, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. Now, I want to talk – you alluded very briefly to the fixes that we're kind of finding,
right,
because that's how we do it in America. We create the mess first, and then after the fact, we come up with some fixes. But before we get to that, I want to touch on a couple more things about fracking, specifically the fracking – fluid that's used. Am I mistaken that there was a governor of one of these states that actually drank some of this fluid to show that it's great if I can drink it? If it's good enough to go in a governor, it's good enough to go in the ground.
Who did that? That's John Hickenlooper of the great state of Colorado. he actually was – he sort of got pretty well known in Colorado because he ran a popular brew pub. So he knows about drinking.
Well, I was going to say this almost feels kind of like microbreweries, the way each company has its own special blend of fracking fluid. It has that same kind of feel.
The thing I like best about that story is that he did this. He was sitting there with Dave Lazar, the CEO, chairman and CEO of Halliburton. And this was a new product that Halliburton was coming out with called Clean Stim, which was built from ingredients you would find in the food industry. And after that, Halliburton had to put a little disclaimer on its website that says not intended to be imbibed or something like that.
Because it sounds so artisanal. It sounds like something, you know, you might have like in Brooklyn or something.
Yeah.
But he did make sort of a public display of drinking some of this stuff.
No, he did. You know, Governor Hickenlooper is an interesting character because he is really trying to stake a position that you can have drilling in and around major metropolitan area. I mean, the drilling takes place very close to Denver. You can have the benefits, the jobs, the tax revenue, but you can also do it safely. And you know, we laugh a little bit about his quaff, his famous quaff, and you know, in all, we should, because it was a little bit of a political stunt. But he's really been out in front in terms of trying to create new regulations and try to figure out how to do it right.
Well, what are some of those regulations? What you referred to the fixes. What is being done to do fracking right?
Well, one of the things that they're doing out in Colorado, and I think this is really interesting, is that they're trying to tackle air emissions. Because when you have, you know, when you're doing lots of fracking, lots of wells, you have open wells and various chemicals can leak out from the open wells. And you also have compressors everywhere. I mean, there's lots of machinery around. And one of the things this is just about a month ago he did this, put in some new regulations that are going to require companies to go around with infrared cameras looking for leaks, because they're having, you know, what they want to do is they want to stamp out chemicals and methane coming out. It creates smog. And if you leak enough methane, methane's a very potent greenhouse gas and can contribute to climate change, which is, you know, natural gas when burned to make electricity is much better for the environment than coal. And we've seen lots of coal plants taken offline and replaced with natural gas. So that's been a real benefit for the environment, for climate change. But if you're leaking a lot, then you know you can reduce some of that benefit. So Colorado's really been very focused on trying to tackle that problem. They're really the first to really try to tackle that leakage problem.
Now, in states like Texas, an investigation by the Center for Public Integrity found just 5 air monitors in a 20,000-square-mile radius.
Yes.
And often very, very far away from the drilling site. So do we really know what's coming out of a lot of these fracking wells if that's the level of monitoring that's being done?
You know, that's an excellent question. And the answer is certainly in Texas and elsewhere, no, we don't.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that in a recent article I argued we need to do is before any well is drilled, we need to have air. We need to sample the air and the water. And so that way we really know what is the impact and what can we address. Because we've seen situations like in Dimmick, Pennsylvania, where there was lots of arguments and lawsuits over water. And the divisiveness lasted for years because there was no really solid evidence about what did the water look like before this got started. Now, I'm not making an excuse. I mean, it's certainly very possible that poorly constructed wells impacted the water, but let's at least take that off the table. Let's do the testing beforehand so that we know when there's been an impact. And that way, the bad actors will get weeded out and there's more of there's just more of a regulatory push and more muscle. Because you're absolutely right. I mean, how can we have any idea how much is leaking, how many chemicals are coming out, or diesel fumes, if we're not monitoring them, if we have so few monitors over such a large area?
Well, the problem, too, is that, as you put it, a regulatory push means money. You need money to do this. And Texas actually has slashed its Department of Environmental Quality's budget, and that's not a shocking piece of news in and of itself. But is the EPA even equipped to monitor these sites? Do they have the kind of budget or the kind of, capacity to do that?
You know, right now they don't have the budget, or at least not the budget allocated to do that. But there's a lot of potential money on the table, you know, because there's so many wells being drilled. Pennsylvania, for instance, they put a permitting fee, and they're trying to generate money to that to pay for the inspectors. So basically saying, look, if we need to have inspectors running around the countryside looking after you guys, you're going to pay for it, and we're going to just put a usage fee on it or a permitting fee. We're having this incredible oil and gas boom. It's generating lots of money. It's generating lots of revenue. There's absolutely no reason why we can't take a sliver of that to pay for inspectors and regulators to make sure that we're doing this right. Because otherwise, we're going to find ourselves in a situation in 20 or 30 years, and we're going to look back and say, wow, we just squandered that. You know, we squandered all the potential benefits because we let all this happen.
Right. But until we do, you're right, there's a lot of money on the table, and there should be more than enough money to cover regulatory fees to pay for monitoring and more watchdogging. But in the meantime, who is mining the store? Because it feels like there's some wells being drilled that we don't even know, like, oh, they just drilled a well and they sort of did it, you know, and then we find out about it. Are we in this sort of open-ended phase right now where a lot of stuff is going to happen that we're going to later regret because, you know, we were in such a rush to do this?
You know, we've been through the rapid expansion phase. Mm-hmm. That was sort of 2008 to 2010. These companies mm-hmm. were leasing land as quickly as they could. And once you lease the land, you sort of have this countdown clock. You have to drill a well on it. So they're drilling wells as fast as they could to hold the land. We've gone beyond that. the industry itself has slowed down. This is the perfect time we're in right now to get some of these safeguards in place. The running at top speed has ended. But to answer your other question, who is minding the store? One of the things I was really amazed by in traveling throughout the country was the number of local community activists, mayors, people who never set out to turn this into their lives. It was just sort of thrust upon them and became incredibly well-educated about this and became really strong advocates and who said things like, look, if you're going to drill here in the middle of our town, this is what you need to do. You need to have sound walls. You can't be running trucks in at all times of the day. You need to put a monitor here. That the industry knows that its social license to operate, that its ability to keep doing this is hanging by a few threads right now because fracking is incredibly unpopular and people are incredibly upset about this. So when they're pushed, they're making a lot of these changes right now because they're getting pushed, because people in the communities are fighting back. Colorado is a perfect example. They just last November, four communities voted to have a moratorium on fracking. And I don't think it was a complete coincidence that a couple months later, the governor and three of the largest oil and gas companies all come together and have this press conference and announce a new set of regulations that are going to, you know, so it's like when you have the community getting involved and saying, we want to make sure this is done right and, you know, we're going to cause a ruckus, the industry is responding. And so, you know, we're seeing that happen all across the country. You know, I personally feel that this can be a net benefit. There's a lot of good that comes from having affordable energy, and natural gas is a low-carbon energy. There are plenty of potential benefits. We're seeing rapid growth in renewables, enabled in part by having so much natural gas to back up wind and solar. And so there's just lots of positives out there. We just need to remain vigilant, I suppose.
I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate. I'm WNYC and WNYC.org, and I am speaking to The Wall Street Journal's Russell Gold, who has written a new book called The Boom, which is a history of fracking. You know, one of the most iconic images of the fracking era comes from the documentary Gasland, in which tap water in a kitchen is actually lit on fire. How often does that happen? Or is that just one of those things that sticks in everybody's mind, but it was sort of an outlier?
No, it was an outlier, but the data isn't really very good, you know.
What caused that to happen? That sort of scary image.
Well, we don't exactly know, and that's part of the problem. You know, it's sort of in some ways it goes back to the old Willie Sutton quote. You know, why'd you rob banks? Because that's where the money was, right? Well, why do companies drill where they drill? Because there's natural gas there, and so in a lot of instances you have natural gas that will be naturally moving up into the aquifer. In other instances, you drill a well and you're supposed to, when you drill the well, you encase it in cement, which supposedly blocks off methane or anything else from leaking up from way down below. Well, if you don't do the cementing right, then you can have migration up the backside of the well and into the aquifers. And, you know, you might sort of think, well, cementing, that's kind of a silly thing to be focusing on, but that's what caused the Deepwater Horizon to blow out, was a bad cementing job. So it's critically important. And if the companies aren't doing a good enough job, and if they're not making sure that these wells are secure, you can have methane, natural gas, leaking up, and it will travel up the backside of these wells, and it will look for the areas of low pressure, and those happen to be water aquifers. So they get into the water, and then the concentration builds up. And then when it comes up into a house, you can light it on fire. The good news is that is not a regular occurrence. That's not happening all across Pennsylvania. But we don't know exactly the numbers because the state has not been particularly forthcoming with those numbers.
There's also been an uptick in earthquakes in places like Oklahoma. Haven't they been linked to fracking? And what's happening geologically that's causing that to happen?
Yeah, no, absolutely. The fracking of rocks itself does not cause the earthquakes. What causes earthquakes is when you put the water down into the well, you pull a lot of it back up, and the water is tainted and needs to be cleaned up. And often, instead of cleaning it up and recycling it, they'll put it down what's called an injection well, disposal well, and you're basically just taking the water and shoving it a few thousand feet underground. And those injection wells are essentially lubricating earthquake faults. And mm-hmm. These are earthquakes that would have happened maybe in sometime over the next 10,000 years, but we're lubricating the fault, so it's slipping, and we're speeding it up. So, you know, there's a really simple fix to these earthquakes. we do not ask, when we permit an underground injection well like that, a disposal well, we don't ask, is there an earthquake fault nearby? Is this somewhere we should be putting water down or not? You know, let's ask that question. It seems like an eminently reasonable question. So if we know where the earthquake faults are, well, guess what? We don't put water down there.
Right. But my question would be, who's – you say let's ask that question, but who is going to ask that question? Well, that's you brought up a very good point of like these local communities. It seems like a big – earthquakes seem like an enormous problem to put on the shoulders of mayors and local activists.
Well, okay, here's the good news. You know, I'm up here from Texas. I live in Austin, Texas. The state of Texas just hired a seismologist. We're finally going to
be – Texas.
you need seismologists. You need people who actually understand this, working hand-in-hand with the regulators and saying, okay, well, if you're going to permit an injection, well, it has to come to my office, and I've got a map of where the active earthquake faults are and where the faults are and why you're going to put a stamp that says yes or no. But, you know, that gets at a really important point, and that is that all too often in states like Texas and North Dakota and elsewhere, the agency that is the regulator, that's the watchdog over these, is the same agency that's charged with being the cheerleader and the rah-rah, let's go out and create this industry and create more tax revenue. And that's just a really bad recipe. You have to separate the watchdog from the cheerleader. You have to have separate agencies, because otherwise there's so much pressure that's going to be put to rubber stamp and to keep the economic development going by drilling more wells. So that's, once again, something that is eminently reasonable and really should happen. The federal government's done it, but the states have not followed suit.
I know you said that some of these the products of fracking and natural gas production, natural gas leading to electrical production, is better for climate change than some other things. But aren't you concerned about some of the other effects are actually bad? Byproducts are bad for climate change, such as methane.
Right.
Are we paying a price on the other end that's going to really balance off the advantage we're
There's
gaining?
Been some really good, in the last just year or two, peer-reviewed studies, several of them coming out, not paid for by the industry or by foundations that are opposed to fracking. And what they say is that with what we know about methane leakage, it's still a benefit to drill for gas and to use it to create electricity and shut down coal plants. And there's plenty of low-hanging fruit, pneumatic valves that you can replace to reduce methane leakage even further. That certainly needs to happen. But, you know, the other thing that people often say is, you know, well, you either have to be pro-renewables or pro-fossil fuels. You know, you have to take a stand. You've got to choose a side. And that's not always necessarily the case. I mean, natural gas, if you want to – right now in the country we have 1% of our electricity from renewable energy. And a lot of people say, well, how do we get to 5%, 10%, 20%? That's a really difficult task to get there. And, you know, it involves balancing this massively complex electrical grid. And the people I talk to say, well, if you want to have a much more nimble electrical grid, you have to have a lot of natural gas on it, because, you know, you can flip it on and off like a light switch, basically. So there are ways in which you can really use natural gas to promote the growth of renewables.
Well, I've been speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Russell Gold. His book is called The Boom: How Fracking Ignited the American Energy Revolution and Changed the World. Russell, thanks so much.
Thank you.